being perceived as inadequate romantic partner, and there's some stereotypes of Asian American men being sexually or romantically inadequate. So these are some of these factors that create a sense of marginalization that could predispose them to suicide or suicide ideation.
Welcome to the Shared Experiences Podcast with Josh Baker and Casey Eisenberg. Tune in as they discuss the often stigmatized topic of men's mental health. With the help of the occasional guest, they want to help you come away with the tools to be successful in your everyday life. So sit back, open up, and enjoy the show.
Okay, everybody, we have an extra special guest for you all today. Today we have on Professor Joel Wong. Joel, thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
If you could just elaborate for our audience here, kind of what your background is, what you've dealt with over the past few years.
Sure. So I am a professor of counseling psychology at Indiana University. My PhD is in counseling psychology. And I do research in a variety of different areas that are seemingly very different from each other. I do some work on gratitude and the psychology of gratitude. I've done some work on Asian American mental health, as well as Asian American gender issues, including Asian American men. And then I've, for the longest of time, studied what I call the psychology of men and masculinities.
Yeah, that's all seems like within our wheelhouse. So I wanted to start off talking about gratitude because, Josh, I'm sure you agree with me. It seems to be an underrepresented topic in
Absolutely.
Men's mental health, something that I feel like people don't practice enough. And so I read one of your studies. I think it was called On the Catalyst Model of Change. Am I reading that correctly? The Catalyst Model of Change. So can you give a brief summary of that to our listeners and the benefits it may impose on people?
Well, in that article, I was kind of proposing a model, calling it a theory, of how gratitude interventions and practices produce positive outcomes for mental health. Right? I'm not going to go into all the details, but my basic premise is that gratitude is essentially and fundamentally a social emotion and a social strength or virtue. And so the pathways through which from gratitude leads to positive mental health and this theory that I proposed are all social in nature. So things like, you know, when you're more grateful, you become better able to connect with other people in terms of relationships, as one example. When you're grateful, you're more willing to participate in pro-social behaviors, like doing something positive for other people. There's actually some interesting research showing that when you're more grateful, it also has an effect of inhibiting bad behavior, uncivil behavior, like bad things that you do. You do lots of that, and so on, right? And so in that model, I did propose a number of like specific practices or aspects of gratitude activities that will lead to these positive outcomes. I can talk more if there's some interest.
Yeah, no, that's very good information. I wanted to ask you questions on two pieces. I really liked your points where you're saying how not just practicing gratitude, but improving on how you practice gratitude. And two pieces I think that you focused on, which I really enjoyed to see, was frequency and variation of how you practice gratitude. Can you speak on how people can change how they practice gratitude and maybe practice it more often as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in this model that I proposed, the frequency of gratitude is simply one of the best ways to maximize the benefits of gratitude. And by frequency, I mean, you know, small doses of gratitude all the time, every day. I'll just give you one little example from my personal life, and it's something I recommend to everyone. I call it vitamin G. Vitamin G for gratitude. And why do I call it vitamin G? Because number one, it functions like a vitamin. You know, how long does it take to pop a vitamin? 2 minutes, 1 minute, you know? That's all it takes. And it's really cost effective. In this case, vitamin G is free. And all you need to do, what I do every day, is I just spend 5 minutes just writing in a gratitude journal. And I just write three things I'm grateful for. And sometimes I try to think about why I'm grateful. So, you know, I might say something like, I'm grateful for X because of Y. It takes me 5 minutes. And that's the frequency. So that's kind of a habit and a daily habit. I've done this for years. It's probably the best and cheapest investment I've made in my mental health. All right. But there's other things you can do. So you start with that. But, you know, in our daily lives, we all have times where on a daily basis, we're sort of not necessarily doing anything that is particularly productive. Like, you know, you're not working, like you're bathing, you're driving to work, you're mowing the lawn, or you're waiting in line for your Starbucks coffee. And I think those are moments to just practice gratitude. So, you know, sometimes I'm mowing the lawn and I kind of make this a challenge for myself. It says, you know, while I'm mowing the lawn, I'm going to think of 20 things. I'm going to count 20 things I'm grateful for. The most I've ever got to was 50. Mowing the lawn. I just count it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you know, I would say start slow. You don't aim for 50. Just say, you know, I'm waiting for coffee. By the time I get to the line, I'm just going to recount in my head 3 things I'm grateful for. I'm driving to work 15 minutes. Before I get to work, I'm just going to count. I'm going to verbalize, you know, nobody's in a car, say it out loud. You know, I'm grateful for this, grateful for that, 2 or 3 times. And that's just the frequency of gratitude, I think. It's just one of the best things you can do.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Do you think in today's modern age that the art of gratitude is essentially a lost art and that people don't practice it, I guess, often enough, perhaps compared to how much they used to?
Yes, I do agree that gratitude practices used to be more prevalent in the past. Now, I want to say something about the way gratitude practices has evolved over time and history. And it's fascinating because in my research into gratitude, I didn't just look into the psychological work on gratitude. I started looking into philosophical, historical, theological accounts, cultural accounts across history. And one of the things I've concluded is that the way gratitude has been practiced has changed over time. Well, first of all, today, when people think of gratitude, you know, they often associate it in the U.S. context with like, oh, yeah, gratitude, you know, practice gratitude to be happy, practice gratitude to have better mental health. You know, I wrote that article about how gratitude can lead to better mental health, but that's not how gratitude has been traditionally thought of. You know, we're talking about Roman times. In the Roman Empire, we're talking about medieval times. Gratitude was perceived as a virtue that is inherently interpersonal, right? So you received a blessing from someone and you want to express gratitude because that's the right thing to do. You want to be able to bless the person who blessed you. And for these people in the past, it would be sort of meaningless if you just kept those thoughts in your head and you just sort of practice it in your mind, like what I talked about, thinking about it, you know, when you're bathing and like, you know, when you're mowing the lawn. You got to be able to verbalize it, or in many cases, you know, do more than just verbalize it, but, you know, often it involves gifts, exchange, you know, doing something good for the other person. Now, I am not advocating that is the only way to practice gratitude. I mean, obviously, you can tell. You know, I'm all for practicing gratitude in your minds or keeping it privately. That's great. But I do see there's some value in that interpersonal exchange. That part has been lost, I feel. And I hope can be emphasized a little bit more in today's society.
Yeah, and something Josh and I discuss a lot is the loneliness epidemic of men. You just talked about how people lost that interpersonal connection. And something I noticed within your work is that when you seem to practice gratitude, it almost causes a feedback loop where practicing gratitude more can cause you to have more pro-social behaviors, make more meaningful relationships, which in turn could probably make you or have give you more gratitude in your life. So can you speak on a little bit how maybe this loss we've had of social connections over the years, especially within young men, and what gratitude can do to fix that?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, I've advocated for keeping a gratitude journal, having grateful thoughts. So do that. There's also interesting research showing gender differences in gratitude. Men are less likely to be grateful than women. Men are less likely to verbalize gratitude than women. And so I think there's a lot of missed opportunities here for connection. So my challenge for men, for young men, is to go beyond just practicing gratitude in your thoughts, in your writing, to actually verbalize it and to speak words of gratitude to someone else. And it just multiple benefits. Feedback loop is exactly the term I would use in this expression of gratitude. So if I'm expressing gratitude to you, just the mere fact of my focusing your goodness, it helps me to see the good in people. That's a good thing, right? It focuses my traits, my thought on goodness. It also makes me, this research showing that just being able to verbalize that makes me happy because I'm focusing on good things. Now, I've just blessed you and 95% of the time, not 100%, but 95% of the time when you express gratitude to someone else sincerely, the other person is happy too. Their person is, it's funny because people are often grateful for the receiving gratitude from others. They're grateful for gratitude. So the other person is grateful to you because you express gratitude to them and then they respond positively back to me, right? So if I say I'm grateful to you and I read you this gratitude letter, you might be really moved. Sometimes the recipient will cry and they respond positively, say, oh, thank you so much for doing this. I had no idea that you felt this way. And so that's a feedback loop. It comes back to me and the receiver of the gratitude ends up blessing the giver of the gratitude. So it's a double blessing that comes back to you. And you're just like, wow, and then it builds that connection. So it's a very beautiful picture here. Now, there's one other piece to that. If this is just a dyad between two individuals, right, then the gratitude is just shared among the two. But imagine if there is a witness to that gratitude. So you have like, for example, a group of guys coming together, three or four of them, and one of them expresses gratitude to the other person, the presence of the other guys. Well, the research shows that even witnesses of gratitude, witnessing the expression of gratitude, you're not the person expressing, you're just witnessing an authentic expression of gratitude, you experience some joy out of that, right? And you feel more connected to the people, you experience some joy, you feel more connected to the person expressing the gratitude, and you feel more connected to the person receiving the gratitude. So now we've got a triple blessing here, where you've expressed gratitude to someone, they bless you back in return, and the witness who's witnessing you is now more connected to you. I think it's great.
Yes, gratitude's contagious.
It's contagious. It's positive contagion.
Quick question on that as well, because I've often found myself encountering this, even in terms of my own gratitude, which is proximity bias. So the news is a international place now. We're hearing news stories from all over the world. So we know that there's a lot of atrocities and things taking place in countries overseas. But for many of us, including myself, a lot of those atrocities are so far removed from our reality. You can sympathize for those people, but it's hard sometimes to truly be grateful having not experienced that. Are there ways around that? Obviously, like if you're lucky enough to grow up in an amazing household with a good family who's financially supportive and all of these other great aspects, is it harder for that individual to be grateful? And if so, what are some ways in which they might be able to reframe their positioning?
Oh, such a great question. I have a lot to say about that and very practical tips I can offer. What we do know is that a person's life circumstances does predict their happiness, but only to a certain extent, right? We know that because we've got a lot of rich celebrities who are incredibly unhappy and incredibly ungrateful. And you look at their life circumstances and objectively, they have everything that they need, but they're still incredibly unhappy, right? We know that. And sometimes they know it too. They know it's like, yeah, I know in my head that I should be grateful, but I just don't feel it because it's just my life sucks. I feel terrible. And part of the reason is because if you surround yourself with people who are rich and good looking and successful, that become your, those people become your reference group, right? And they might even be better than you, objectively more. You know, if you have, if you're a millionaire, but you live in a neighborhood with billionaires, you know, you feel a bit like a pauper, right? So that's what happens. Our evaluation of our life circumstances is inherently tied to our surroundings, who we surround ourselves with, all right. So that's a very that people grasp that concept. So if you know that, then there is a simple solution, which is that, you know, get out of our comfort zone, get out of our shell, and connect with people who are less fortunate than us. It's one of the reasons why volunteering, you know, doing volunteer work is associated with happiness. Now, there are many reasons why that might be the case, but to me, one pathway is you are, you know, you're in a soup kitchen, you're serving people who are poor and who are much poorer circumstances you are, and then all of a sudden you begin to realize, I think my life circumstances aren't too bad after all, you know? So it's that exposure to people who are less fortunate that actually is in a strange way healthy. So that's my tip number one. Suggestion number two, and this is more of like a mental trick that you can play, like a Jedi trick. And there's research showing that, by the way, of kind of like how do you experience great gratitude when, you know, you've had a kind of a comfortable life and yet you don't feel appreciated, is to do what I call this positive mental subtraction, right? Which is, you can do a journaling activity and try to imagine that, you know, some of the good things that you currently have are gone from your life, subtracted from your life. And you try to imagine what your life would be like without those good things. And write about it. Journal about it for like 20 minutes. Like, give you an example. Imagine that, you know, your partner, your life partner, you've never met this person, is missing from your life. Try to imagine your life without your life partner. And all of a sudden, you become grateful to your partner. All of a sudden, you become grateful for the things that you're taken for granted now suddenly become more valuable when you realize, you know, that it could be missing, right? A third variation of that is to imagine that the, you know, whatever possessions that you have are going to be gone, or whatever thing that's valuable to you is going to be gone in a day's time. Imagine that you're going to die in a day's time, or your partner's going to die in a day's time. You know, if you were arguing with your partner and having a fight, and if you imagine that your partner's going to die in a day's time, honestly, would you be fighting for the toilet paper?
I hope not.
You know what I mean? It's like, this is nonsense, right? You just put things in perspective. You know your partner's going to be gone in a day's time. It just changes. You start seeing your partner in a different light.
Yeah, perspective is something I think a lot of people are missing today, especially, you know, like Josh, you said, people in similar situations as us, where we've had a lot of great fortunes in our lives and still may not feel the satisfaction or happiness. But getting some perspective on life, I imagine would be highly valuable. But Professor, I want to pivot a little bit, since you are such an expert on a variety of topics. Unfortunately, I want to pivot to a little bit more of a depressing topic, but it was the study of Asian American suicide. And specifically, I was hoping you could have some points on young men, since that's the focus of our podcast. So could you speak on any of the issues that Asian American young men are facing right now, and what may be causing these rates of depression and suicide?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. A chunk of my research has addressed Asian American suicide related outcomes. Many of the outcomes are similar to, so many of the risk factors are similar to those found in other populations. Probably one of the best predictors of eventual suicide is a previous suicide attempt. It's like common sense, but that's one of the biggest risk factor. Depression is a risk factor, having suicide ideation. Some other factors that are not as well known, but actually are very big risk factors. Impulsivity is a lack of fear of pain. That's not a very well-known risk factor. But if you are fearless and you don't have a fear of pain, that's actually a bad thing. If you fear pain, that's actually a protective factor. exposure to violence. And it's where you have men who are at higher risk for suicide. And in fact, there's this really interesting gender paradox where women have higher rates of suicide ideation than men. And by the way, this is pretty much consistently quite true for almost all racial groups. But men have higher rates of suicide than women. And I've looked at that data and dissected it by race, by age, every single combination of race and age, and every single group within the U.S., men consistently have higher rates of suicide than women, but that women have higher rates of ideation. Why? Again, suicide has a number of special risk factors that are different from depression. So we often think of like, oh yeah, depression, suicide, they're related. Yes, they are related, but there's some additional factors. And those additional unique factors, unfortunately, predispose men to suicide. All right, those are the factors that I've just talked about, right? Impulsivity, exposure to violence, fearlessness, lack of fear of death, lack of fear of pain, lots of violence in your life. All of those are additional risk factors that pushes people men into suicide. Well, firearms, if you own a gun and you use a gun, that immediately again puts you at much higher risk for suicide. And suicide attempts tend to be unfortunately much more successful when you use a firearm as opposed to other means of success. The success rate for firearms is unfortunately very high, more than 90%. Specifically for Asian American men, there are some additional risk factors that are, you know, more kind of unique and related to race. And we even refer to it as a gendered racism, a form of racism that's more gender related. So my colleagues and I, my former student and I, developed a measure of Asian American gender racism. And so some of the more unique factors might be feeling a sense of emasculation, like I'm not masculine enough, or like people are stereotyping me for being less masculine in whatever way, being perceived as an inadequate romantic partner. And there's some stereotypes of Asian American men as being sexually or romantically inadequate. So these are some of these factors that create a sense of marginalization that could predispose them to suicide or suicide ideation.
Along those lines, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on or any knowledge on how mental health specifically is approached in Asian American men. And then perhaps along those lines too, if the stigma for Asian American men is the same as other racial groups.
Now, we know that men in general are less likely to seek professional mental help than help seeking as compared to women. So that's consistently been shown in research. We also know that Asian Americans are one of the least likely group to seek professional mental help. And so you have a double whammy of both Asian Americans and men together. In fact, there's some research showing that for suicide ideation, you find that Asian Americans have lower rates of seeking help than whites. No, that's probably not a surprise, but even lower rates than Hispanic, Latino populations. So really low rates. And that's sometimes been known as Asian Americans, sometimes it's been known as hidden ideators. Hidden ideators meaning that you didn't know, they're walking around, you had no idea. They were thinking of killing themselves. They didn't disclose it to anybody, didn't tell a friend, didn't tell a counselor, and then they just did it. Before you know it, they've done it. So that's a concern. And I said, for Asian American men, you've got the race and you have the gender put together. That's a concern in terms of low rates of help seeking.
Another point I wanted to ask about is if you have any advice for these men. I know you spoke about issues of racism and the propensity to seek mental health at a lesser rate. If you could speak on any other issues that are facing Asian American younger men today, and what advice you would have in order for them to maybe improve their mental health at all, or at least their health overall.
What I'm seeing both in the research and also from my previous counseling practice is that for some Asian American men, there is an insecurity about their masculinity. Like, what does it mean to be a man? This might show up in really interesting ways where you might have an Asian American man coming for counseling, if they actually show up, And the goals could be, I want to be taller and speak with a deeper voice, right? I want to have more muscles. There is that sense that others are perceiving them as less than a man, and they are perceiving themselves as less than a man. And you know, they're internalizing what you see in Hollywood, where you don't have a representation of Asian American men, and they're seeing, you know, these men out there who are macho, assertive, aggressive, and you're saying, I don't look like that, but I want to be like that. All right, so that's an area of insecurity that counselors have talked about in counseling men, and we've seen that also in the research. And so for Asian American men who are dealing with those issues, I'm not certain the solution is like, oh, you want to build a six pack, I'll help you. You want to grow taller, well, let's see what we can do. I mean, there are limits to what you can do, right, physically. But maybe what I'll try to do is to help them redefine what it means to be masculine, and to develop a certain level of security in what it means to be a man. And to say that, look, you know, society is sending you these messages about what it means to be a man, but is this the only path? Are there other societies that have defined masculinity in different ways, right? Or perhaps, do we even need to focus on masculinity? Is that the basis of our identities? Are there other sources for your security and your identity, other than how macho or how masculine are? So you may not even need to redefine what it means to be masculine. It's just, I just don't want to focus on that. So those are the things that a counselor or a therapist might work with an Asian American man who's struggling with some of those issues.
Now, when we talk about Asian American men, obviously that encompasses to a lot of different countries. Are there any country-specific problems that people, men specifically, would encounter here? So say perhaps they may do things slightly different in China versus Japan or Korea, or would you say a lot of the issues are pretty much cumulative for the most part?
My guess is, and again, I think I want to refer more to ethnicity rather than country. So I'm talking about Asian Americans who live here in the U.S., so like Chinese Americans or Japanese Americans. I think there's some similarities. Where you might see some differences could be between the experiences of South Asian American men versus East Asian American men. So because of, you know, physically, they look different, right? So South Asian American men, I'm referring to men who are of like Asian Indian descent or Pakistani descent, where as opposed to like East Asian would be Japanese, Chinese, and Korean. South Asian American men, interestingly, sometimes have slightly different experiences where they might be perceived to be slightly more masculine compared to East Asian American men, and perceived to be more compatible with that of a leader or that of a stereotypical man. Some of it's fascinating. Some of it even has to do with bodily hair. That's just weird. There's actually research on that. And people associate bodily hair, like a beard, with being macho or being masculine. And so that sort of bodily hair seems to be sort of stereotypically more connected with South Asian American men. So that's some of the differences that we've observed. I will say that South Asian American men may face additional challenges. I mean, I made it sound like they may have some benefits, but some of the challenges they may face is also they are sometimes mistaken for Middle Eastern men, Arab men. Sometimes Americans can't tell the difference. It's like, you look kind of dark skinned, you kind of look all the same, a Muslim. And so with that, you have the terrorist stereotype that might be imposed on some of them, and it's obviously awful.
Yeah, again, perspective much needed in the U.S. in a lot of cases. But you were making some really good points on masculinity, and I know that's another area of your study. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about it overall, not just on the Asian American men's standpoint. So if you could talk about just the harms that's going on with the pressure to be masculine that's going on in the U.S. Josh and I often talk about a lot of things like social media. I know you talk about those videos of guys going out and being macho and getting muscles and everything like that. So can you just speak on a little bit and maybe point to some of your research on the harms that this is putting on men today?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that if you speak to a lot of men privately, you know, they'll tell you that they don't necessarily believe in the need to be stereotypically masculine in a variety of ways, like, you know, in terms of being aggressive or being competitive or having lots of sexual partners or building up muscles. So they don't necessarily personally endorse it that strongly, but they perceive that others endorse that. That's how other men, society, and that's what others are believing should a man should be. And so that social pressure then creates coercion. It's kind of like a it's a force of psychological coercion that pushes men to do these things. And sometimes that social pressure is even internalized, right? But you know, if you look at research, you see that there's actually some disconnect between some of the privately held beliefs that men have about them, about what they want to do, versus their perceptions of what other men expect them to do. Well, that's a fascinating thing that we can expose.
How did masculinity develop, I guess, via evolution to be such a highly discussed trait?
There's a very interesting theory of masculinity called the precarious manhood theory. And according to that theory, manhood is different from womanhood. So when I say manhood, what I mean by manhood, I mean men's status, social status as men. It's different from women's social status as women. I'll talk a little bit about that and we can speculate on how this developed historically. So according to the theory, and there's some evidence backing up this theory, compared to women, men's social status as men is a lot more precarious. Precarious means it's unstable. It's, you know, it can be lost anytime. And so men are constantly required, or so they think they're required, to prove that they're sufficiently manly. And it's proving, it's a social form of proving. You're proving to others. And that if you do anything that suggests that you're somehow not as masculine, that you have to compensate by performing more masculine acts. And there's a lot of fascinating social psychological research documenting this precarious manhood. I mean, just to give you one kind of a standard experiment that's used. If you participate in an experiment and I give you some false feedback, and I tell you, Josh, that you're not really that masculine. In fact, I you know, you fill out a questionnaire and I say, you know, you fall into 25th percentile of masculinity, right? But see, the research, the survey that you just completed shows you are the bottom quartile of masculinity, okay? Right? What's going to happen is that you are more likely to engage in risky, reckless behavior after receiving that feedback, right? And so according to this theory, that's your way of restoring your manhood. You have been, your manhood has been threatened. And now you need to be able to do something macho to prove that you're sufficiently masculine. When the same kind of experiment has been shown with women, where women are threatened that same way, show that, you know, you're the bottom 25th percentile, they don't seem to react the same way. You know, so it seems to be an interesting gender difference here. Now you can speculate on like why or how that developed, you know. Did our ancestors, were they, you know, hunters and fighting, competing against each other to constantly prove who's the most macho person, or fighting with this wild animal as a way of demonstrating a masculinity? Who knows? You can adopt a variety of historical interpretations of how that came about. But this notion of man constantly having to prove socially, publicly prove to others that are sufficiently macho is fairly well documented.
That's interesting. Honestly, Josh, we were talking, I'm watching the new show, Chimp Empire. Yes. And it does seem, I don't know if you've seen it, Professor, but it's basically a documentary about chimpanzee troops. And it's honestly crazy to me how their social hierarchies are very similar to ours and what you just talked about, where the alpha male of the group, you know, who has mating rights to everyone, is the strongest one of the group. He's the most confident. He's often displaying his strength throughout the troop. And he has to fight every week other males to keep his status. So it seems like we haven't moved very far.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like precarious manhood. Constantly fighting, constantly trying to prove publicly that you're manly enough.
Do your students ever come to you with questions or concerns about their own masculinity? Do you advise them at all on that?
No, I've not had any, you know. We do sometimes talk about it, you know, just sort of in terms of personal applications. No, I haven't had someone tell me like, oh, I don't feel sufficiently macho. What should I do? Not yet.
Maybe they're saving it for the therapist.
I mean, obviously, this is, you know, deeply personal, too. It's not just like research that you do because, you know, as I start thinking about this in my personal life, too, I mean, I think I do encounter threats to my manhood, you know, every now and then, right? And doing this research has helped me to think a little more critically and to even come up with a response, you know? So a couple of years ago, you know, a friend of mine came to my home and I'll just share. I have two cars at home, right? Back then, I had two cars. One was a Toyota Camry, and that's the car that my wife drives, and the other is a red Suzuki Aero. If you don't know what a Suzuki Aero is, go Google it. It's a kind of a small hatchback car. It's red in color. And my wife, my friend look at the two cars, and I said, which car do you drive? I said, I drive the Suzuki. And he said, that's the car you drive? You know? And for that split second, I felt like my manhood was threatened. You know, just like, you drive that car? Why? Why do you drive that car? I thought of it for a second. I looked at my friend, and I said, you know, I'm pretty secure in my manhood. That's what I said. But I didn't respond to this. I said, you know, I think I know what this is about. And I said, for the split second, I felt my manhood threatened. I came back together, and I said, I think I'm cool. I'm really cool. I'm comfortable driving this red little car, small little red car, and I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that's another example of displays that men have to put on, right, is what car they drive if you're not driving a perceived macho car. I mentioned, you know, way back in the day when we used to be monkeys, how masculinity used to be then. But I want to talk about now, or at least ask you, about how masculinity has changed in recent history, probably in the around 50 years ago today. So how has the conversation of masculinity adjusted? I know social media has been a big thing that's changed the conversation. So what do you think has changed about how masculinity is perceived in the last 50 years or so?
I don't know if this will be what you're thinking of, but what I'm seeing is greater fragmentation and diversification. Some of it's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. So we, as academics, we use the term masculinities, not just masculinity, the plural form, to signify that there are actually multiple versions of masculinity. So that's really been a fragmentation of masculinities in the last 50 years, where they are now, I mean, you could argue in society there's a dominant form of masculinity, sort of the most honored way of being a man in the societies. Academics sometimes call that hegemonic masculinity, like the most honored version of masculinity. You know, when you're competitive, you're assertive, you're an alpha male, whatever you want to call it, you're an athlete. But then they're also kind of subcultures, right? And so that's the diversification that takes place. There are subcultures of masculinity that takes place. For example, there's gay masculinity, right? Where a group of gay men come together and they behave very differently from the alpha male, but they're like very comfortable with who they are. And they hang out with other men who are like them. So that's one example. There's the, what you might call it, like the tech masculinity, where these are men who work in the tech industry. They're sort of geeks. They're not necessarily known for their athletic prowess, you know, and maybe even may not be, but they're known for being competitive and smart and creative. But that's where they find the expression of masculinity, in being able to work really hard and be very competitive, but they're not necessarily athletes, right? So that there again, you see some diversification, whereas we're talking about 100 years ago, everyone, I mean, it's like there was no tech and, You know, one of the ways you express yourself domestically was through physical activity. So now with the knowledge economy, you have, you know, kind of more ways of expressing yourself. There's also religious forms of masculinity, where men who are very religious kind of sometimes combine a mix of very traditional forms of masculinity with more sensitive expressions of masculinity, that men should be emotionally involved and in touch with their feelings and caring. But then they should also be traditional in a sense that, you know, we maintain traditional gender roles. So that this has led to some interesting diversification.
Yeah, I feel like too, being at Indiana University with all the Greek life, you probably get firsthand exposure to traditional masculinity. Yeah, right. That is plenty to study there. Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, lots of stuff coming out from Greek life. Absolutely.
Do you have any thoughts on where masculinity is heading into the future? What do you think? So we talked about what it looked like 50 years ago versus today. What do you think masculinity will look like 50 years from now?
I think that's anybody's guess as to what's going to happen. My guess is this wild speculation is that people have sometimes talked a little bit about kind of a crisis in masculinity. And I'm going to even briefly draw a connection to politics here. So crisis in masculinity in the U.S. in a sense that in the past, you have men who, like, you know, there wasn't many opportunities for jobs other than physical labor. And so men had the inherent advantage over women, right? If you thought of physical labor, to sort of career opportunities. But now with, you know, the rise of technology, you have the many things that women can do that men can do in terms of career opportunities, right? It's now your brains, you know, your knowledge, your intellect matters sometimes even more than your physical prowess. And so for many men who were sort of unable to keep up with the new economy, that's led to a loss of jobs, the jobs being shipped overseas, you know, if your only skill was that, you know, I can carry heavy things, then you're kind of unskilled labor. Some people have talked about how even that crisis in masculinity, sort of shifting trends in an economy that affect men, has led to unhappiness, men being disgruntled, and that's in some way related to the rise of Trump, who has a lot of support from, who has more support from men than women. So it's, because Trump appeals to some of these men here. So that's kind of what's happening here in the U.S., right? Where is this going to lead to in the future? I don't know where this will lead. My hope is that there will eventually be some kind of a redefinition, a reconceptualization of masculinity, where that there's that decoupling of physicality from masculinity, because that's a strong link that's existed for centuries. To be masculine is to be physical, strength, brute force, height, muscles, right? And my hope is that there'll be some decoupling of that over time, where people are beginning to see different expressions of masculinity that's not so tied to kind of physical work, and that to me would be a more liberating form of masculinity that would liberate men and ultimately benefit women and benefit society too.
Yeah, I agree with you, Professor. I have a feeling it's heading more towards the intellect realm, and with the ability of machines to do most of the work that was required of us 100 years ago, it seems like it's going to be about who could control the machines the best. To wrap up here, I want to be respectful of your time. I want to ask you a question on research in men's and masculinities. I understand that you were one of the chief editors for the APA journal Psychology of Men and Masculinities, and specifically in your portion, and looking to the future, I want to ask about what areas you think we're lacking in terms of men and masculinities, and what you'd maybe hope to study in the future and to answer some of the questions that we have today.
So one of the fascinating things about study of masculinity is that masculinities are what I call ubiquitous, meaning that it's everywhere. It's everywhere, and not just attached to men, but I argue that it pervades all of our everyday life. And there's research showing that even the food we eat, we ascribe gender meanings to it. Certain foods are considered more masculine than other foods. It doesn't take rocket science to figure that out. You know, if I want to pose the question back to you, if you want to make a guess, what kind of food do you think would be less considered less masculine and more? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to go with a burger and a salad. Exactly.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like tofu versus steak, which is more masculine. You see, that explains, that's a very simple explanation for why men are much less likely to be vegan and vegetarians. It has to do with the meanings, the gender meanings we ascribe to food, right? So eating this burger, you know, it's steak. It's also a reason why, you know, men are often not particularly helpful in the kitchen. But if you see men cooking, what would he be doing? Barbecue, right? Steak. One of the areas of research I think is most interesting, I'd love to see more work, is how masculinities are ascribed and attached to not just human beings, but to a whole variety of different things, to food, to careers, to academic subjects, to the cars we drive. Remember my Suzuki Aero that wasn't very masculine? To give you an example, electric cars, to a wide variety of behaviors. Once you understand that masculinity is everywhere, you begin to understand why there are gender differences in a whole variety of different things. Gender differences in different types of sports, gender differences in types of careers, the type of food you eat, etc. Interests. And that, I think that's an interesting area. It's worthy of more study.
Professor, again, being respectful of your time, I greatly, greatly appreciate you being here. This was a really insightful, super interesting conversation. And I'm sure our viewers will love it.
I just want to say, you know, thank you for drawing attention to issues of mental health among young men. And anything we can do to destigmatize mental health, destigmatize help seeking for mental health is good. And so my message to any, you know, any man out there is that if you're struggling with mental health issues, you know, you're not alone. The thing is, you're probably one of many men who are struggling, but just who are just too afraid to admit it and just come out and seek help. And it's going to be liberating for you.
You heard it from one of the experts, guys, not just us.
Yes.
So, Professor, again, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate all of your insight and expertise that you gave. Thanks again. And guys, thanks for tuning in. Josh and I say we have a lot of episodes in the backlog of other guests. We have many more experts coming on in the future, even some colleagues of yours, Professor, that Deborah recommended to us. So please tune in and thank you all for watching.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.